Thanks, Manny, for introduction. So I think I will have enough time, so feel free to ask questions during the talk. Today I'm going to talk about three main topics. First is about quantum sensing, so how entanglement will help us in quantum sensing. And entanglement can help us do quantum key distribution. And finally, I will talk about entanglement enhanced communication. And if I have time, I will talk about potential open problems. So the quantum sensing part is in collaboration with my advisor, Jeffrey Shapiro, and the previous postdoc in our group, Jishen. And so typical quantum sensing includes two scenarios. First is hypothesis testing, in which you want to learn whether there's a target there or not. So this is a discrimination between two discrete hypotheses. And the other case is parameter estimation. For example, if you know that there's a target, but you want to learn what's its velocity moving towards or away from you, or what's the distance from this target is away from you. So to be a bit more abstract, these cases can be described by this channel parameter estimation scenario, where you input some quantum state into this black box described by a quantum channel with unknown parameters. And then from the output, you try to determine what it is, these unknown parameters. In the hypothesis testing case, you do a discrete POVM. And then in the parameter estimation case, you do a continuous POVM. And this performance of these two cases can be evaluated in different ways. So in hypothesis testing, I think due to historical reason, people care more about detection probability and the false alarm probability. Detection probability means that if you assume that a target is present, then what's the probability that you actually make the decision that it is present? False alarm means that when the target is not there, or when something is negative, but you predict that it is positive, or the target is there. So if you take a Bayes point of view, these two probabilities will give you an average error probability if you assign priors on the targeted presence and absence. And for the parameter estimation case, it's much simpler. The deviation performance can be described by this deviation measured by the covariance matrix from this measurement result minus the true parameters. And however, because it's a big matrix, usually we want numbers. And in this case, we can define penalty matrix G, and then the cost would be the trace of this penalty matrix and this covariance. So when we have this performance matrix, this ultimate performance can be bounded by this so-called Hausdorff limit or Kramerov bound, which are only determined by the quantum state you're using and the channel you're probing. In the hypothesis testing case, if you have identical copies of the input, then this Hausdorff limit is further simplified to a quantum Chernoff bound, which is exponential in the number of copies, number of row-ins you have. And this QCB is this so-called error exponent given by this quantum Chernoff exponent. In the parameter estimation case, people have this Kramerov bound, where the optimum measurement can saturate. And in multi-parameters case, this will be more complicated. But in the single parameter case, this corresponds to the quantum Fisher information directly. So how will entanglement help us in different scenarios in quantum sensing? Here's a general picture. So there is the traditional way of using input-output relation. But besides this single input and output, you can have an ancilla that is entangled with this original input. And after you get the output from this black box you want to probe, because this ancilla is stored in a quantum memory, ideally, there may be some remnants of this entanglement left after this probing process. And afterwards, the measurement can be done jointly on this output and ancilla to give you better performance in estimation these unknown parameters. To be more specific, let's consider some examples. For example, here, we are interested in this target detection. And we call this protocol quantum illumination. What happens is that these entangled pairs are produced by shining a very strong laser pump on a nonlinear crystal, where it has these spontaneous parametric downconversion process happens and produces upconvert and downconverted signal and idler pairs that are entangled. And these signals are sent out to probe this potential target that is embedded in noise. And usually the target is very lossy. So when the light comes back, if it's still somehow correlated with this idler pairs, then it means that there is a target there. But if the light coming back are all noise that is irrelevant with this idler, then the target is absent. So if you assume that we know the target reflection and we know the return phase of this light, then this quantum channel of this quantum illumination, the optimal performance can be given by this quantum Chernoff bound represented by the red lines here. This plot is a number of copies of inputs and the error probability of the target detection process in a log-log scale. And we see this red curve is the optimal performance of quantum illumination. And this blue curve is this optimal classical method where you use you don't use entanglement, but you use coherent states. We see a huge gap here. This is one example, but when it's first introduced, we don't know how to make a measurement in this detection scheme. So what we worked on is to design what kind of measurement will be optimal for this target detection state discrimination problem. And this receiver, so this measurement device is called a receiver in target detection. So this receiver composed of multiple cycles, and between different cycles, the Bayesian formula is used to update this information obtained by in measurement. And in each cycle, this is a schematic plot. It's kind of complicated, but the key component is this sum frequency generation process. So what is sum frequency generation process? It's basically the inverse of this nonlinear crystal. This is the spontaneous parametric downconversion. And if you inverse it, shine an idler and a signal that are entangled on this nonlinear crystal, then ideally you will get a non-zero pump in the output. So this is why we want to use sum frequency generation in this process. So any correlation between the signal and idler will be converted to the displacement in the sum mode. And we use some tools from classical radar theory about coherent state discrimination, which people invented these optimal receivers called Dolinar receivers and Kennedy receivers in the 70s. And then we use Monte Carlo simulation to confirm that this architecture will indeed give the optimum performance in quantum illumination. And because in realistic quantum target detection, you don't know what's the reflectivity of this target exactly, and you don't know what phase it is. So I further extended this to the case where there's a target fading, which is a standard model in radar theory that your target has a fully random phase and certain prior distribution of the reflectivity. And the quantum advantage is still present in these cases. Here's another example of how entanglement can enhance this target measurement problem. Here, we want to know what's the velocity the target is moving and how far away it is. So to detect these two parameters, we use photons, of course. So photons interact with this target by Doppler shift and the time delay. So the velocity of this moving target will input a Doppler shift on the frequency of this light. And the time delay of the reflection will correspond to the distance. However, the difficulty is that these two parameters have non-commuting generators, meaning that if you have only one photon coming back, you cannot measure the frequency and its arrival time precisely simultaneously, restricted by this so-called Arthur Cayley uncertainty principle. So to get around this uncertainty principle, we use an entangled idler pair. So this is analog to the so-called super dense coding model, if you are aware of it. I don't want to go to details of this scheme, but the rule of thumb is that with this entangled assistance, the number of photons you want to receive on this lossy channel is decreased by a factor of two. And you can measure both the frequency and the time precisely. So these two are simple scenarios where you have entanglement from a stored ancilla. And besides this, you can also have entanglement between different inputs in this probing process. And often, in these cases, people have found this so-called Heisenberg scaling of parameter estimation, where the standard deviation of the parameter you're estimating is inverse proportional to the number of inputs. So in this scenario, we worked on this so-called distributed quantum sensing with continuous variable multipartite entanglement. So this entanglement is generated by very simply just by shining a very strong squeeze state on balanced beam splitters. And these output modes will be entangled in a multipartite way. And what we want to probe is the displacement operator represented by this U hat. And of course, the channel will be lossy, so we introduce some loss and represented by this N eta. And the detection process is simply homodyne. So everything here is just off-shelf from very simple experiments. However, with this simple equipment, we show that this would enable a Heisenberg scaling in the detection of these displacement operators, the amplitude of this displacement. So why is that important? Because these displacement operations we perform all the time in, for example, in these quantum key distribution protocols. And so you want to measure this displacement precisely to make sure that your key distribution process is secure. And in other systems, for example, this code-added system, this spin angular momentum can be reduced to displacement in the light when this you consider the light-Eaton interaction. And what's more, so LIGO is basically a giant interferometer. And within LIGO, what happens is that this phase shift in one arm of this interferometer is transformed into displacement of the outcome beam by inputting coherent lasers in the income beam. So it basically, we want to probe displacement in LIGO, systems like LIGO. So if we have multiple LIGOs and we want to enhance this performance by entangling different interferometric systems, this is a way to do it, and it gives you an entanglement advantage. So this is the first part about quantum sensing. If you have any questions, feel free to ask me. So if not, then I will go on to the second part about quantum key distribution. So these are the collaborators. What's the goal in quantum key distribution? So we want to be able to do this so-called one-time pad communication. In a one-time pad, Alice and Bob want to share perfectly identical and secure bits of zeros and ones, so that if Alice wants to send a message, he can add the original message, plain message, with this secret key to obtain the ciphertext. And the ciphertext is perfectly secure because of the addition. And then to decode this ciphertext, Bob simply adds the shared randomness with this ciphertext again. And then by modular addition, you get back this original message. But the problem is there's no way of distributing these secret keys in the no perfect secure way to distribute these keys in classical communication. People always rely on certain complexity assumptions. But quantum key distribution, on the other hand, offers a way to distribute these perfectly secure keys. and with this only assumption that quantum physics is correct, and you can model your experiments goodly with some theoretical models. So the figure of merit in quantum key distribution is this key rate, so-called key rate, meaning how fast can you generate the secret keys, either in per-channel use basis or either in per-second basis. So this is formula is given by earlier by Defcott in Winter, and the first part is IAB, means this mutual information Alice and Bob can generate in a key generation process. And the second part, IE, is eavesdropper's information gain about these secret bits. And the important part in quantum key distribution theory is to place upper bounds on this eavesdropper's information gain. And this is the asymptotic key rate, by the way. So here's a comparison of current mainstream quantum key distribution protocols at 50 kilometers fiber loss, or the transmissivity is 0.1 distance. So we see that there were different protocols, but the rate is about less than 1 megabit per second, which is much slower than your internet, which can transmit gigabit of data every second. So the reason is that the rate is fundamentally limited by the loss. And in these protocols, they all use one mode, one optical mode per channel encoding, meaning you only encode the classical message on a single optical mode and send it over. And the results from private capacity of this pure loss channel shows that there's upper bound on how much keys you can generate by this way. So we want to go over it. The way to do it is to use many modes per classical bit encoding, which is straightforward. And we boost the key rate by a factor of 50 or more at 2017. So here's how we do it. We call this protocol flat-light quantum key distribution because we are using many modes per classical encoding. So to do this, we use broadband sources, and all these operations are broadband. And I don't want to go too much details in this. So here I will show you in a more direct way of how these two-way quantum key distribution protocols work. So to start with, Alice have multi-mode light source, these red balls and blue balls. They represent many modes of entangled pairs. And then Alice send the first part of these entangled pairs to Bob's side. And because there will be an eavesdropper who has a quantum computer and everything allowed by quantum physics, the correlation between them may not be that entangled anymore, but you can certify that certain correlation is still there by making measurements. And after you make sure that there's still a certain amount of correlation and you want to continue with the key distribution protocol, you can. So this is a random, you either randomly measure to make sure that the correlation is good, or you either randomly choose to encode your message on. This is a standard procedure in quantum key distribution to ensure security. And when you encode message, Bob performs local operations on these red balls. And then we can do amplification on these optical modes. And then the light is sent back. And because Alice has the original entangled pairs, even though in this whole process, the entanglement may be gone, but still this entanglement can enhance this decoding process, which Alice can decode Bob's encoded message much better than some eavesdropper in between. And because there's an information advantage, then by the standard privacy amplification process, you can generate perfectly secure keys afterwards. This is how the experiment looks like. And more importantly, we need to, you know, we have a quantum key distribution protocol. We have very nice key rate. But the important thing is that we need to prove it's secure. So in order to prove the security, here's an abstraction of what's happening in these two-way quantum key distribution protocols. So at Alice's side, this R and W is this red ball and blue ball, which are originally entangled. So R and W are entangled pairs. This signal R is sent towards Bob. And eavesdropper in between is doing these arbitrary unitary operations on her ancilla V. And in that way, eavesdropper can generate an entanglement assistance E, represented by this E here. And after Bob received these signals S, Bob can perform these encoding operations. And afterwards, Bob may want to do some more operations, or there may be some internal loss in Bob's lab. So there's another channel, Psi. And after this, the light is sent back to Alice for further measurement. But to bound eavesdropper's information gain, we make this assumption that eavesdropper is obtaining all the return light. In this way, we are obtaining the upper bound of the information gain leaked to the eave in this process. But if we do this assumption that eavesdropper is obtaining all the return light, one can show that the information gain in this process falls under the region of so-called entanglement-assisted classical communication. And in entanglement-assisted classical communication, people have studied these ultimate information transmission limits a lot. And earlier, we invented a capacity that is suited for this set of problems. And the information leaked to eavesdropper will be limited by that capacity. And capacity formula is additive, meaning that collective attack is optimal in this scenario. Collective attack means that eavesdropper only masks the light you send in a single round, but she does not entangle the light between different channel uses. But in general, eavesdropper can entangle the light in different channel uses by, for example, quantum memories stored and general unitary operations. And because of this additivity feature of this formula, if you obtain this from this security measure, you obtain constraints on the covariance matrix of this optical mode. And then from this Gaussian extremality result in continuous friable systems, you can show that a collective Gaussian attack would be optimum that maximizes eavesdropper information gain. And this scenario can be applied to different two-way QKD protocols. As long as it fits into this pattern, where Alice first generates entangled pairs and send one to Bob, and Bob encode on it and then send back to Alice to decode. And you can use this approach to obtain some key rate bound. So here's a short summary for the quantum key distribution part. Feel free to ask any questions. So then I will talk more about this information theory where we use entanglement to enhance communication. So these are the collaborators. And to remind you of what is channel capacity, so in classical communication, Shannon formulated this channel capacity in the maybe 1950s, I don't remember. But so in these communication scenarios, we describe this input and output relation by a channel. And in classical channel, it's just a map between two numbers. Input is X, output is Y. And it's described by a conditional probability distribution. When you input one, what's the property of getting out one or zero, and the other way around. But in the classical communication case, Shannon showed that robust classical communication is possible even when the map between X and Y is noisy. And but the communication rate will be below the so-called capacity, which has a simple formula here. It's a maximization of the mutual information of X and Y under this probability distribution, and maximize over the input distribution. So you can choose what kind of input distribution of x to send, and then this will determine this distribution of y. However, in the quantum scenario, it's more complicated because we not only have classical bits, we have qubits, and we can encode classical message and a quantum message onto some quantum state and send out. And this quantum state can be entangled between different channel uses. This is similar to the quantum sensing, where the quantum state you send over the channel multiple times, they are entangled. And furthermore, you can also entangle this input state with an ancilla. So there can be all types of entanglement. And this ancilla is assumed to be distributed to the receiver before this communication happens. And upon receiving output and ancilla, the receiver performs some joint measurement and decodes the original classical message or quantum message. So this means that we can not only send classical information, but we can send quantum information, and we can generate or use entanglement. So the capacity region of a quantum channel is really the triple trade-off of CQE, which represents classical communication rate, quantum communication rate, and entanglement consumption or generation. So there's a nice work which gives a formula how to give these capacity regions. I don't want to go into details of this formula, but it gives you a region in this space of classical communication rate and entanglement consumption or generation rate and quantum communication rate, a region where things are possible. And outside this region, it's no longer possible to communicate with vanishing error probability. So this is the general region, but we can also have a look at subregions, meaning that if you don't want to send any quantum information, we don't use any entanglement, then we only have classical capacity of quantum channels. Similarly, if we don't send any classical information, we don't use any entanglement, we have this quantum capacity of these quantum channels. And another subregion, which is a point, is that if you have unlimited amount of entanglement assistance, you have this so-called entanglement assisted classical capacity. And in this case, Q equals zero because you are not sending any quantum information. And you can also have the case where you use some amount of entanglement and you send classical information. So then there will be a trade-off between the entanglement you use and the classical information you send. If it's an identical channel, then it's a very simple straight line where if you use one e-bit, you can send two classical bits. If you don't use any e-bit, you only send one classical. So if you use one e-bit, you can send two classical bits. But if you use zero e-bits, then you just send one classical bit. So there's the issue of so-called subadditivity because of additivity because earlier I said that the signals between different channels can be entangled arbitrary way, which means that to obtain the optimal encoding or to evaluate the capacity formula, how many rounds of channel uses do you need? If we call the channel to be additive, if this evaluation can be done over a single channel use, and we call this channel non-additive if this evaluation requires more than one channel use. So it is known that this classical communication capacity can be super additive, which means that if you only optimize over one channel uses, the quantum state in one channel uses, you won't get the optimum communication rate. So this is shown earlier by Hastings et al. And you do require this entanglement between two channel uses to evaluate the capacity. And on the other hand, if you have unlimited entanglement for assistance in your communication, and this entanglement are pre-shared by the sender and the receiver, then the evaluation of these capacity formulas don't require any entanglement between different channel uses anymore. So here, A1 and A2 are the two signal states you're sending, and E1 and E2 are these entangled assistants. So A1 and E1 are maximally entangled, and A2 are maximally entangled. And in this scenario, if we don't constrain what amount of entanglement we can use, the evaluation of the formula doesn't require any entanglement between A1 and B2 and A2. So the case where the capacity is additive means that you can evaluate more easily. The helper space you're optimizing over is only a single channel use. In qubit case, then it's a single qubit. But if it's super additive, you need to look at multiple channel uses, and the helper space would be over the qubit, but tensors the amount of the number of channel uses. And usually, we need to regularize into arbitrary number of channel uses, which means the helper space you need to optimize over very large, and the problem would be very difficult. So to shine some light on this problem, we consider the following question. So yeah, previously I've told you that when you have unlimited entanglement, then the channel capacity is always additive. And when you don't have any entanglement assistance, on the other hand, the channel capacity can be super additive. But if we restrict the channel into a subset of general channels, such that their classical capacity is also additive, this means that in this CE trade-off regions, the two endpoints of this channel are all additive. So when you don't have any entanglement, or when you have unlimited amount of entanglement, you all have additive capacity formulas. But the question is, in between, when you increase the entanglement from zero to maximum, will you always have additivity, or will the channel capacity be super additive in between? So we constructed an example where in between it can be super additive, meaning that this case we restrict the channel to be additive, and in that endpoint we also restrict the channel to be additive, but in between, when you have limited amount of entanglement, the channel suddenly becomes non-additive. And this construction uses the idea of a switch channel. So the input of this switch channel consists of two parts, A and M. M is sort of like a classical bit. It can be a qubit, but because afterwards a measurement is performed on it, so it's essentially a classical bit. And then condition on the measurement result of 0 and 1, the switch channel either switch to N0 or N1. N0 and N1 are two quantum channels that you switch between. And this N0 channel, they are additive, and we choose them to be classical channel. So entanglement assistance doesn't increase their communication capacity. And channel N1 is a so-called random unitary channel, or random orthogonal channel, constructed by Hastings, which is super additive for its classical capacity. However, we construct these two channels in a way that their classical capacity are equal, which means that if you only consider classical capacity, the overall channel is additive because of this classical channel there. But when the entanglement amount limited amount of entanglement is increased, you want to use the quantum channel more because the entanglement can help the communication of this quantum channel. So then you want to design the input such that the switch actually switch to this quantum channel to get this entanglement advantage. So then, because the switch switched from classical channel to a super additive quantum channel, so this entanglement makes this capacity switch from additive to non-additive. And we also extended this result into different trade-off regions. So general result is that besides two special cases where additivity of subregions means that additivity is over the whole region, all these other claims are not true. We can construct counterexamples. And another thing we want to think about is most of these capacities are actually can be super additive. So can we construct some capacity that is always additive and allows noisy entanglement in your channel use? And here's a construction where certain constraints are put on these communication models, but the general message is that this capacity is additive and it upper bounds the information gain in quantum key distribution protocols. I think I don't want to go too much details in it. So here's a summary for this entanglement assisted communication. So we construct additive to non-additive and then additive transition. And then we define some additive classical capacity, but can be assisted by noisy entanglement and has applications in quantum key distribution. I think here are these, here's a time, I think if you have questions, I will stop here first. If you have questions.
Can you say a bit more about the noisy entanglement result?
Oh yeah. So in this scenario, these inputs of these quantum channels can be arbitrarily entangled. And this ancilla and these inputs can be arbitrarily entangled. And they don't have to be in a pure state. They are in a noisy quantum state. However, the encoding operations are separable, meaning you and the receiver and the sender share noisy entanglement, but the sender performs separable local operation on this multiple number of signals to send the classical messages. And the amount of entanglement in this scenario, you can write a set of constraints on how much entanglement you have. And we do require the set of inequalities only involves quantum states, reduced quantum states in different channel uses. However, this constraint will allow general entanglement between different channel uses. So under these two constraints, first is this local encoding operations, and second is the form of this constraints of the entanglement is special. But otherwise, the state can be arbitrarily entangled. And under these scenarios, the channel capacity formula can be proved to be additive. And there's a connection between this communication scenario where you do have these pairwise constraints on this entanglement, because in quantum key distribution, you measure this signal and idlers in a pairwise fashion. So that's a natural way to think about in quantum key distribution. And also in quantum key distribution, we always encode random bits of zeros and ones. So we always use local operations to encode. We don't use joint encodings. And that's why this is involved, can be involved with quantum key distribution protocols.
Say more about the constraints. What is the resource?
Okay. Here's probably more clear. So this states you're using is this S and E here. So S is the signal state, and E is your entanglement assistance. And the joint state of S and E is not pure. And there is some purification W in general. So the joint state of S, W, E is pure. So the constraint is really on this S and W. These constraints, I can give examples. For example, if I constrain that S and W are not entangled, then this means that the signal and the ancilla you use, this S and E can be arbitrarily entangled. But if I constrain that S and W are maximally entangled, then I don't allow any entanglement assistance from E anymore. But if I have some inequality, so let's take a bipartite entanglement measure on S and W and the constraint that it's entangled greater than certain amount, then the possible entanglement you can use from this entanglement assistance E is constrained. This is how these constraints are constructed.
Okay.
So other questions? Now, if not, and questions we can also discuss afterwards, but let me talk something about some potential topics I want to work on. Along the quantum sensing direction, I want to consider quantum sensing in big systems. So in these systems, it's many body systems, and it can be entangled in a very very complicated way. But you want to measure the global property of these systems. For example, if it's a Gibbs state, you want to measure its temperature. But in experiments, we only perform local measurements. So how well can these local measurements measure global properties of this material or this many-body system? This must be this can be related to these correlation measures in these many-body systems. And I think there was something interesting that can be worked on in these measurement properties. So the basic question is, how will local measurements perform if the property you are measuring is actually a global property, for example, the global temperature? So if you have a Gibbs state, temperatures can be only defined for the global system. The reduced system may not be in a Gibbs state anymore. So if you only look at local systems, how will you perform measurements? And how will that perform? And along the quantum cryptography part, I think this security proof of quantum key distribution protocols and designing new protocols will be interesting to me. And the better requirement for security is for the finite key region, where you only use limited amount of communication rounds. And in that case, different tools need to be used to prove security and to bound the key rate. And I think in two-way key distribution protocols, these are also something that can be explored. So my previous security analysis is only asymptotic for the case where asymptotically you can have infinite rounds of communication to generate keys, and what's the asymptotic key rate. And if you have a finite number of channel uses, the story will be different. And also, so quantum key distribution is just only designed for one-to-one communication. But in our networks, we don't have this point-to-point connection. We have a very complicated network. So in that case, if you want to share a secret with multi-parties of people involved, so how do we do it? And what's this constraints, or what's this ultimate rate of key distribution can you achieve in these complicated networks? There were some preliminary results by Koji, and I think this is a direction that can be explored in more detail. And the understanding of non-Gaussianality is something I also want to explore. So Gaussian states are the set of states that are easy to generate in labs. Most of these entangled sources I talked about are all Gaussian states. For example, these two most squeezed vacuum states. And these coherent states are also Gaussian. So however, the power of these Gaussian states and the Gaussian operations are really limited. So they cannot do universal quantum computing, and they cannot perform entanglement distillation for Gaussian states, and they cannot perform error correction. But we need some component of non-Gaussianality, either in quantum states or in the quantum operations. But how do we quantify the amount of non-Gaussianality you use to perform certain tasks? This can be interesting to explore, and I think resource theory will be used. The frameworks of resource theory will need to be used in this theory. And more importantly, wanting to really have operational meanings for this resource theory. For example, how much computation you can perform, or how much entanglement you can distill. How are they related to this amount of non-Gaussianality you use? This can be a very tough question. And also, I'm interested to consider photonic-based quantum computing protocols. Previous protocols, for example, there's a linear optical quantum computing where this post-selection on the measurement result are used to generate non-linearity in these interactions between different modes. However, that is only probabilistic. So if we want to do it deterministically, we do need some nonlinear operations. For example, we can consider chi2 operations, chi2 interactions. And also there were some proposals, recent proposals by using feedback operation to enable this interaction between different photons along the time direction and along the space direction, and they form some sort of cluster state that will be helpful for quantum computation. I think in general, it will be an interesting question. And this is also related to the question of non-Gaussian results, because so the quantum computing is one way of using this non-Gaussian resource if you have non-Gaussian operations. So for example, these chi2 are non-Gaussian, and time delay feedback is non-Gaussian, and this post-selection on with this number photon number measurements are also non-Gaussian. Then I think that's so much I want to talk about. Feel free to ask me questions, and we can discuss afterwards. I think I'll be here today, tomorrow, and Friday morning. Yes.
So for the floodlight QKD, have you thought at all about attacks when the devices used on Alice's and Bob's side are imperfect?
That's a good question. So I think that's also a next step that can be considered in these protocols. And for now, we assume that the models for this device at Alice and Bob's side are still perfect. But indeed, I think deviations may be a problem here, because we do require precise measurement of indeed security monitorings. So I think that's something interesting to look at in the future. But up to now, we haven't considered.
There's kind of known attacks against BB84 that detector blinding. Does that type of thing work here, or is it?
I haven't thought about more, but I think that device attack can be dangerous in this, because you can probably fake this measurement result, or because single photon detectors are used, so there will be similar issues, similar to the case in BB84 where you use similar detectors.
For generalizing to coherent attacks?
Coherent attacks?
Yeah.
So,
the Fanetti kind of theorem? Or?
In two way, I kind of have a different approach other than De Finati, but this approach isn't complete yet. The measurement part is really tricky, because if you have all these things entangled together, the measurement statistics would be very complicated. And if you use De Finati type of argument, the measurement part may be easily solved. And on the other hand, if you don't use that argument, I have some results showing that the capacity formula of eavesdropper, meaning the eavesdropper's information gain is upper bounded by an additive formula, meaning that coherent attack cannot be more powerful than collective attack. But that requires obtaining these constraints. That assumes that you can measure everything precisely. So that will only work in the asymptotic case. In finite key region, I think it's an open problem.
The bound that you can obtain with this upper bound?
Pardon?
So how tight are the bound that you get?
That's a good question. So the assumptions in this upper bounding is that we are giving eavesdropper all the return light. So in realistic scenario, eavesdropper can only get certain amount of light in the return channel. But we are giving everything to her. So that makes the bound untight in cases in short distance, because at short distance, the loss is actually very low. So if a eavesdropper can obtain like maybe 50% of the light at several kilometers, and then if you give everything to Eve, the bond can be non-tight with a constant factor sometimes. But at a longer distance, let's say at 100 kilometers in fiber, the loss is 0.01, meaning that eavesdropper is getting 99% of light already. So giving her 1% light more on the return channel won't make the bound too much untight. So the general message is that at longer distance, this bound becomes more tight. At short distance, this bound is not tight.
Okay.